homeowners being hit with bills in the hundreds of thousands of dollars after slips. This is in the capital, and the slips have been pretty much on the rise in recent years, Georgina Campbell, haven't they? The frequency of them, it seems, and impacting on often on private homes.
Yes, Mordena, Catherine. We heard from a really compelling story, actually, from a resident who lives in Vogeltown in Wellington, and he addressed a Wellington City Council committee meeting recently. His name is Tim Foote. He's had two slips on his property in the past year, leaving him with a $300,000 bill. So the first slip fell at the back of the property in February last year when Cyclone Dovi hit, and he said when it came down, it sounded like a freight train. I think it would have been quite scary. He was home at the time. The second slip fell at the front of the property during that really intense rain that Wellington experienced last winter. It was our wettest winter on record. By the time the couple had engaged engineers who had started work, the hill then started to crack and their deck actually started moving. So, as I said, the total repair bill is $300,000 and EQC has covered $98,000 of that. So it's left them with a $200,000 gap to cover. They've hit the ceiling in terms of what the bank will loan them, and luckily their parents have stepped in to help, but they're thinking they're probably well into negative equity now. This situation was interesting too because it exposes a few quirks with EQC, which I'm sure listeners in Christchurch will be very familiar with. But one of the slips slid onto City Council land, and because the couple didn't have an easement on the footpath, they say that they potentially missed out on an extra $60,000 from EQC. So just one example of many people in Wellington who are dealing with these awful slips.
And the challenge is, as you say, when it ends up being private land meets council land, and you know, I was talking about the issue with the pipe leaks with the three local mayors last week and asked where liability lies with this, and of course got a complete non-answer that lawyers will have instructed. But it really is an issue trying to, you know, navigate and negotiate. I don't know in this instance whether there's any implication of a possible impact of a failing pipe, but I know of other cases where there are.
Yes, it becomes very tricky and difficult to navigate when I think a lot of Wellington residents actually don't know anything about what it's like to be in this situation. You know, what questions do they need to ask? Who do they need to approach for help? And, you know, it got one of the city councillors, Iona Pannett, sort of saying, well, I think if people can afford it when they're looking at buying a property, they should probably get an engineer in to have a look at the ground that the property is actually on. Just like you'd get a building report, I guess, to assess the slip risk. I mean, my house in Miramar is on a hill, and when this started happening, you know, all these slips in the winter, I certainly, you know, had a bit of a poke around, a bit of a nose to see if anything looked risky or not. But, you know, I'm just a resident. I'm certainly not an engineer. But, you know, these slips, they are happening more frequently. Last year, it cost Wellington City Council $1.8 million to clear them all and call out tripled compared with the previous year. They're driven by wet weather, of course, but also in Wellington, because of the topography that we have, there have been a lot of cuts into the slopes to build roads and homes. And I guess as time goes on, you know, they might sort of become more fragile and vulnerable. And I also thought it was interesting, the council did an update on sort of where people are now, and four properties remain unoccupied due to dangerous building notices being issued last year. And in total last year, 26 households were displaced by slips and 12 roads were closed. So unfortunately, it's going to be something that Wellington will have to deal with, and, you know, just more and more of them, especially with the impacts of climate change.
Now, the New Zealand Herald has had an investigative series into the Cook Strait ferries, aptly named Dire Straits, which will appeal to readers of a certain age. But what more has that revealed? Does this also relate particularly to a subject we were discussing earlier, which was this Kaitaki incident weren't lost power in Cook Strait? Is this one of the matters that that you've investigated?
Yes, I thought the Dire Strait name was quite good, although I can't take credit for it. But yeah, I'm quite chuffed with that one. So we have launched an investigative series because the Cook Strait ferries just continue to be problematic. And I think, yeah, they will provide several more stories in the future as well. But I wanted to look at the Kaitaki incident and look at the investigations that are going on. And I actually spoke to one person. He's a Wellington resident who was on board at the time. His name is Andrew McDool. And the Transport Accident Investigation Commission has opened an inquiry into this May Day call. Andrew was quite pleased that that had happened. But when he was reading an article in the Herald, actually, that that investigation could take 18 months, he thought it was a misquote. Unfortunately, it was not. And he says that's just beyond belief. And that's far too long for an investigation. He thinks it's particularly time sensitive when the Inter-Islander is in the process of building two new vessels, which will replace the existing fleet. And, you know, he says any recommendations from what happened with the Kaitaki, you know, need to be incorporated into the design and operational plan of those vessels. So the Commission's chief executive says urgent recommendations can actually be made during the inquiry if a pressing safety issue is identified. So they don't have to wait for the completion if it's really urgent. And the other thing I've found out, which I really wanted to clarify, was whether the same thing that caused the Kaitaki to lose power could happen with these new ferries. So remember, it was a leak in a connection within the Kaitaki's engine cooling system, which caused the engines to automatically shut down to protect them from overheating. So I've since had it confirmed that the two new ships will have independent and redundant cooling systems. And so they're designed with completely segregated engine rooms. So this is good news. So a failure in this part of the cooling system in one of these engine rooms does not impact the engine in the other room, which would allow power to the ship to be maintained. So I think that's quite important that people can have that assurance that they are designed differently and with more updated technology. Now, of course, we've got the TAKE investigation. Maritime New Zealand is also undertaking its own investigation into the incident, as well as an audit of the Inter-Islander and its vessels. And KiwiRail is also undertaking an internal investigation. So there are a lot of investigations. It's just a case of when we're going to be able to read their findings.
Yes, that's a really relevant point when it comes to the fact these ferries have still got at least 2 years to run. In fairness, it's got to be done properly, especially when it's at this level of investigation. One wonders if there isn't, you know, a parallel investigation that could be focused on current seaworthiness. One expects that might be happening somewhere by someone. Georgina, do we know?
Yes, I think that will come under Maritime New Zealand's audit of the vessels. So, as I understand it, I think that will be completed within a few months. It seems like the investigation, if you like, although they call it an audit, that will be the quickest. So we can look forward to that. But as you say, especially with the TAKE investigation, it's a real deep dive process. You know, they have to get into lots of information, talk to lots of people, give writer replies, all of that sort of thing. And, you know, the purpose of that is to make any recommendations, you know, for the entire sector. So it's in line with comparative investigations overseas. And, you know, in some instances, they do actually take longer than 18 months too.
Now, you've had it with people saying Wellington is dying. Look, it's not like it's new either. The former Prime Minister memorably said it in 2013, right? Yes. And a decade on, look, you know, we've discussed previously the state of the Civic Centre, so many buildings closed, etc. We know there's problems on Courtney Place. A lot of people aren't comfortable there at night. There's issues with sexual assaults. And there's also being efforts undertaken to try and combat that. And now the bars are telling us some of those efforts are OTT. But what do you make of the whole, I guess, kind of narrative here that the capital's toast.
Yes, well, I have had a bit of a rant about this because I could just see this narrative creeping back into the media. And I really am sick of people dragging up that comment from John Key. You know, he said it in 2013. And I feel like people sort of use it to justify this onslaught of hot takes about how the capital's golden age is over. And I just think that line is so stale. And it really prompts a wave of pointless nostalgia in my view. And I guess, you know, if you put yourself in my shoes, back in, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s, which is so-called, you know, Wellington's golden age, I think I was about 8 years old, living in Johnsonville. My mum didn't let me watch Lord of the Rings until I was much older, and I distinctly remember a trip to Cuba Street where Blanket Man scared the living daylights out of me. And so there's actually this whole new generation of Wellingtonians who want to have their own golden age, and I think it looks really different to the era that people are so fond of reminding us
it's
over.
It's a good point. I mean, I just think of it as the city of scooters at the moment, terrifying in some instances.
And we've got e-bikes too now.
Exactly. That transformation is coming so thick and fast. I was one of the people who used to say, you don't need to put all these extra lanes around Oriental Parade. We've all been dodging each other successfully for years, but I'm grateful for it now. And that kind of is the vibe, actually. The idea, and this is something to get your head around, the idea of the central city being the centre of the life, it's now more distributed, and it's distributed in part because of this micro-mobility.
Yes, and, you know, I think if people were annoyed when all those cycleways and shared paths were built around Oriental and then around Evans Bay, I think they're amazing now. Like, I always just think it's so fabulous because it was, you just sort of felt like you took your life into your own hands sometimes walking there. And I think there is a lot happening in Wellington. You know, like, you always hear about the businesses, especially the hospitality businesses that have closed, you know, but have you heard that Chart Street is so successful that it's moving into a bigger restaurant space and it's also expanded to Auckland, you know, or Damascus has moved into a permanent venue on Tory Street there. For the businesses that are closing, there are also ones that are opening. And, you know, I think that's sometimes actually a natural kind of, you know, ebb and flow within a city.
The elephant in the room, however, is the cost of living, and particularly for students. And I noticed that Victoria University's role is down somewhat this year. And if you want a student life, mind you, that sort of moves, as you say, as well. Like, Canterbury's now the place to be. It wasn't when I was studying there. Trust me, it was, you know, everywhere else. But so that vibe of where you go, oh, it's Otago, it's here, it's there, that moves around as well. But the cost of living, if you want a younger generation here, is something to contemplate. And that can be combated to some extent with things like transport that is functional and as low to no cost as possible, and accommodation.
Yes, I agree with you. I think housing is our biggest problem, and it is really sad to see, you know, not as many students coming here, it appears. I don't know how they afford to live here. I studied at Canterbury. I couldn't have paid for the rent in Wellington. But, you know, I think it's also important to make the point that we are putting plans in place. You know, we're pulling the planning levers in the district plan to build more apartments. We've got Let's Get Wellington Moving, you know, when it finally happens. But light rail or mass rapid transit will open up this corridor for housing as well as transport. So I think it's also important to remember that these really big transformational changes are in play. I think we will get there, but I certainly don't think the city is dying. I think people, whether they like to admit it or not, there are far too many people who actually like living in the capital for it to be dying.
Yeah. Be nice to be able to get your car across Cook Strait though, Georgina, and there's still some people trying to do that. That would be handy too. Thank you very much. Georgina Campbell is the New Zealand Herald's Wellington Issues reporter.